I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In central Baghdad today, a suicide car bomber killed at least 12 people. General Electric says that three of its employees and two security contractors were among the dead. A crowd gathered at the site shouting "Down with the USA" and reportedly dancing around one of the corpses. Police and American troops were forced to withdraw. A second car bomb went off later in the day in Salman Park, southeast of Baghdad, killing at least 4 people. And yesterday, a car bomb killed 12 in southern Baghdad. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is reporter Ann Barnard of the Boston Globe. Ann, I know you were at the scene of the bombing after the crowd left today. What did you see of the anti-Americanism we've been hearing about?
It's interesting. I was talking to the shop owners on that street, which is one of the busiest streets in central Baghdad. The shop owners were very concerned about their own safety and essentially blaming the American presence. They said if the Americans were not here and if the attackers were not targeting the GMC cars that Americans and foreign contractors typically travel in, then we shop owners here wouldn't be in danger of this kind of explosion.
Well, what is happening here? These two bombings today, another car bombing yesterday, 17 car bombings this month, and it's only the 14th of the month. What is going on?
Well, the biggest concern is that the only hope for an improvement in the security situation in the short term has been that somehow the insurgents would stop targeting or lessen their attacks on the government once it was truly an Iraqi government. Both Iraqi and U.S. officials have said that's pretty much their basis for hope in the short term. If this is any indication, the number of bombings since the new government was announced has actually gone up since the previous few weeks.
In addition, this weekend, two members of the Iraqi ministry were killed in drive-by shootings. Is anyone claiming responsibility for those assassinations? And what does that say about how insurgents are targeting members of the government?
Well, these members of the government that they've been targeting are much more vulnerable than either American officials or the top ministers and members of the government. They're targeting the deputies who don't travel with the same kind of security detail and often live in regular Iraqi neighborhoods rather than in the walled compounds where U.S. officials and the top Iraqi officials live. And no, nobody's taken responsibility for it. It's a very shadowy attacker. And the new prime minister, Iyad Alawi, has made several addresses to the nation where he seems to call on Iraqi patriotism as a reason to stop the attacks, suggesting that maybe he believes that there are some Iraqis among them. But when he talks about it directly, he still emphasizes the notion that these are foreign terrorists from outside Iraq.
Well, as you said, officials had hoped that the indication of a new sovereign Iraqi government might lessen these attacks. Instead, they seem to have increased. What is expected to happen as we lead up to the June 30th handover?
Well, everyone is saying that they expect more attacks. At this point, Iraqi and U.S. officials are in agreement that they think it will get worse, not better, in the next few weeks.
And is there any indication that the Iraqis might also be angry at Iraqis or foreigners who are perhaps targeting the USA but killing other Iraqis?
Yes, I mean, the other side of this picture is people are incredibly angry that Iraqis are getting killed. I visited the family of a young man who was killed in a car bombing about 2 weeks ago, and the father just said, "Why are you doing this? Why are you killing our people?"
Speaking to the insurgents.
Yes, speaking to the insurgents, he says, "Why are you doing this? What Iraqi would want you to use this method? Of course, we all want the occupation to end, but this is not the way to go about it." We also just talked today to the director of one of the main power plants in the country in the southern neighborhood of Baghdad, and he said there was an attack several weeks back on the Russian contractors working on that power plant, which caused most of them to pull out. He says that's had a concrete effect on 5 or 6 projects that were supposed to bring electricity to Iraqis sooner and now have been slowed down because of these attacks.
Ann, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Ann Barnard reports for the Boston Globe. She spoke to us from Baghdad.
A group of militant Islamic clerics in Saudi Arabia is condemning recent acts of violence against Westerners there. The clerics, who have previously opposed the government, say deviant groups are behind those attacks. The statement comes as an American engineer remains missing. His colleague was murdered in a weekend shooting, and another Westerner was shot to death and may have been beheaded in Saudi Arabia last Tuesday. Hugh Pope has been reporting from Saudi Arabia for The Wall Street Journal. He joins us on the line from Istanbul. Welcome, Hugh. And what can you tell us about this latest kidnapping? Who's behind it?
The group that's claimed most of the attacks on Westerners in the last month has been a group called Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. They've posted a film of one of the killings and of the beheading you mentioned on the internet. It is a faction loyal to the ideas of Osama bin Laden. And I think it's a two-pronged attack. One is to weaken the West, and the other prong of the strategy is to bring down the Saudi monarchy, which is, of course, the ally of the United States in the region. And one way of getting at them is by the soft underbelly of foreign workers who make up about one-third of the Saudi population and basically are responsible for the smooth running of the economy and almost all municipal services and other things that you would expect in a country.
How significant is it, Hugh, that these clerics have now spoken up against this group?
It's the culmination of a campaign that the Saudi government has used to rally public opinion behind the monarchy and against the terrorists. It's somewhat successful in that I do think that most Saudis want nothing to do with this kind of terrorist killing.
Well, in terms of the foreign workers, your article quotes a British national as saying that no one in their right mind would stay in the country. Has there been a mass exodus of foreign workers?
Not a mass exodus. It's a slow thing. It's very difficult for people to suddenly leave. A lot of them have rented out their houses at home or are dependent on the income. Also, to be frank, they really like living in Saudi Arabia. This is a very sudden change. There's been decades and decades of peaceful and profitable living in the compounds that they have, which are very comfortable usually. Just in the last weeks, it has become obvious that they're being staked out in their homes and that they are no longer safe in any way. And so I think a lot of people have gone off for the summer holidays with one-way tickets, and they're going to wait and see how it goes before deciding whether to come back.
Secretary Powell suggested this weekend that the Saudis have to devote all their resources to these problems, including the cutoff of funding to organizations that support terrorists. Do you get the sense that the Saudis are doing everything they can?
Some Saudis are. There are some people in the security forces that are trying to get a grip on the situation. But it has to be said that there is a power vacuum at the top. There's an absence of leadership. Getting clerics to say things for you is all very well, but there needs to be someone standing up and saying, follow me. I know the way that will get us out of this. And I fear that none of the senior royals in the monarchy are able to agree on a strategy or on who should be the spokesman for it.
If there is a mass exodus of foreign workers from Saudi Arabia, what does that mean for the economy and particularly for oil production?
It's not just the Westerners who make up between 70 and 100,000 of the 6 to 8 million foreigners in the kingdom. The May 29th attack in Hobart killed 8 Indians and 3 Filipinos, and these communities have never been targeted before, and very worrying for people, because if you're a non-Muslim in Saudi Arabia, you have a red residence permit, and if you're a Muslim, you have a green residence permit. And it's very easy for an attacker to just demand to see it. It's something you carry all the time. If this gets out of control, it would mean that the smooth running of the of utilities, for instance, will break down. Things like oil are further down the road because they're 99% Saudiized.
Hugh, thank you.
Thank you.
Hugh Pope has been covering Saudi Arabia for The Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Istanbul, where he arrived this morning.
Secretary of State Colin Powell is meeting with CIA officials today to find out why a recent State Department report cited a decrease in terrorism when the opposite is true. This weekend, Powell, speaking on ABC's This Week, admitted mistakes were made.
There's a new terrorist threat information center that compiles this data under the CIA, and we are still trying to determine what went wrong with the data and why we didn't catch it.
Shortly after the erroneous report was released in April of this year, Congressman Henry Waxman sent a letter to the State Department saying several major attacks had been excluded from the report, that terrorist attacks were actually at their highest level in decades. He said this then on Here and Now.
The bottom line is that the decline in terrorism so vigorously trumpeted by the Bush administration in fact resulted from a manipulation of the data rather than an honest assessment of worldwide terrorist activity.
Larry Johnson served as a deputy director in the State Department Office of Counterterrorism from 1989 to 1993. He joins us on the line. And Larry, you were also dubious when you read this report. Why?
Well, it wasn't a matter of being dubious. I was simply counting the numbers that were in the report in preparation for a speech. And when I did my initial addition, I came up with a number of 376 dead. And since State Department was reporting 307 dead, my initial reaction was, oh, heavens, I've really made a mistake. So I went back to recount. And I recounted all the dead and wounded listed in Appendix A and came up with 390 dead, which was, you know, a significant increase over what they were reporting officially. And so when I realized that even in their own appendix, they had not added correctly, I alerted State Department immediately, my friends there that I used to work with. And that was about 5 weeks ago.
And when you looked further, what did you see? Did you see also that attacks were missing from the report?
The number of errors, and I believe this was both carelessness in putting material in and not adding properly, is just phenomenal.
Well, now let's stay with that for a second, because as you know, Congressman Waxman is saying that this was manipulation. You don't agree?
No, I don't believe that for a minute. This because of the way the piece is put together. Knowing the people who are involved with it, they would never allow. I mean, these are friends I've worked with now for going over 20 years. They would never allow that kind of manipulation. This was a simple fact that the normal way of collecting the data and putting it in changed. It shifted from the Counterterrorism Center at CIA to this new organization called TTIC, the Terrorist Threat Integration Center. Fact of the matter is, the folks that they put in at TTIC cannot add. They cannot do the basic work that a third grader should be able to do.
Well, how much of a problem is this now for Colin Powell in particular, who also delivered false intelligence on weapons of mass destruction?
Credibility is the most valuable item that you can have in Washington, D.C., and this is destroying Colin Powell's credibility.
Should there have been a safety gate? You mentioned this data center as being the source of the problem, but Richard Armitage, second in line at the State Department, delivered this report.
Right.
Shouldn't he have read it or seen that there was a problem?
Yeah, he doesn't have time to sit down and read the whole report, unfortunately. Those responsible for giving it to him probably should have picked up that there were some real discrepancies. Part of it goes back to this notion you want to be able to trust the information you're getting from the intelligence community without having to double-check it and assume that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. I think in the future, unfortunately, State Department's going to have to do the work that you frankly want the intelligence community to do.
And double-check it.
And the last thing in the world Secretary Powell likes to have is getting called on the carpet for being issuing erroneous information. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a happy day at State Department today.
Mm-hmm. Larry Johnson, thank you.
My pleasure.
Larry Johnson is a former deputy director of the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism.
Just ahead, inside the lives of teenagers who wind up in adult prisons.
And later, can anything be done to contain Iran's nuclear program?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's here and now.
The juvenile justice system was originally established to rehabilitate young offenders and keep them out of adult prisons. But since the advent of laws that give stiffer sentences for drug and gang-related crimes, the number of young people doing time in adult prisons has tripled in the last decade. Now some are questioning whether these so-called enhancement laws are too harsh. Critics include Dr. Louis Lablonsky, a court expert on gang culture.
The gang enhancement law is often misused on innocent individuals who have some association with individuals who are really gang members, and they get caught in the net.
Dr. Louis Lablonsky appears in a new documentary called Juvies, an insider's look into the lives and souls of teenagers prosecuted and imprisoned as adult criminals. Leslie Neal is director of that film. She joins us on the line from New York. Leslie, hello.
Thank you for having me.
What was the impetus for this film?
I was invited to come volunteer teach a film production class to a group of kids at Eastlake Central Juvenile Hall, which is the largest juvenile hall in Los Angeles. And then I began to, you know, hear their stories that these kids are facing time and they weren't even the perpetrators. And what I try and answer in the film is that we've turned back our juvenile justice system. And today, within 10 or 15 years, all 50 states have passed laws to make it easier to try children as adults and send them to adult prison.
And is that because juvenile crime is dramatically up?
No, actually, juvenile crime nationwide is down. I believe it's a confluence of factors that have happened. One, the rise of gangs, and that has led to a tremendous fear of youth. And that's happened simultaneously with an increase in prison construction across the country.
Leslie, tell us the story of one individual who appears in the film, 16-year-old Duc Tha.
Duc impressed me from the get-go. He's a very, very bright individual. And he was facing 140 years to life. He ended up with 35 years to life. He was driving a car, and unbeknownst to him, a boy in the back seat had a gun and pulled out that gun and tossed it up in the front seat. The passenger in the front seat pulled out the gun, shot at another group of boys in another car, didn't hit anybody and didn't hurt anybody, and all three boys got 35 years to life. And Duc had never been arrested before and was not a gang member.
It's a lonely environment. Lived in a six-man cell. Sometimes it gets overcrowded, becomes a 13-man in a six-man cell. It's loud every night. No windows. All you see is dim lights every day. You know, you get an hour of sunlight on Sundays. You don't have your pride anymore. I'm not really Duc anymore.
Now, one of the people you spoke to for the film was former L.A. District Attorney Gil Garcetti.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who prosecuted that case. Did he think justice had been served?
Absolutely not. And he said in Duc's case, this was not the right use of these laws. And when Duc was first arrested and his case was charged, it was an assault with a deadly weapon case. But because the other two boys he was with, were gang associated, they moved it to a hardcore gang unit and increased the charges to first-degree attempted murder. And with the paranoia, the fear that surrounds youth all over this country, when you read about youth, it's usually about them having done something incredibly horribly violent. So there's a lot of fear towards youth in this country. And all you have to do is pretty much say the G word, which we call the gang word, and it's very easy to convict a young person.
What happens to these young people when they are tried as adults and then sent to adult prisons?
Well, what we found out, that most of the girls with the long-term sentences, and I'm talking, you know, 25 years or life sentences, turn to drugs, often will catch another charge, which adds to their sentence or their inability to be paroled whenever they do come up for parole.
And what happens to the boys?
The boys turn to violence. The political structure inside a prison is such that they are pretty much forced to join gangs inside prison. Now, they might not have been a gang member outside of prison, but then they have to become very violent in order to survive. Prison's very racial. You know, I'll never forget the time I had, you know, I had all kinds of races in my class. And I had this young African-American man and this young Latino man. And, you know, we all hugged in my class, and we're all friends, and these two boys would hug. And I went down to follow up with them in county jail, and they were four cells down from each other, and they could not be seen talking, or else their own race would check them, which means beat them up.
There's also someone in the film who was a youthful offender,
mm-hmm.
who then went on to turn around his life.
Yeah.
Do you think it's possible for the young people that you met to turn around their lives in the
yeah.
same way that he did?
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, given the right intervention, the right education, the right rehabilitation, absolutely. I had a warden tell me in a maximum security prison in California, he said, the young people coming in here, they're the easiest population to rehabilitate. And we're not doing anything with them. In California, rehabilitation's been written out of the code of corrections. And that's pretty much been blanketed one way or another across the states, although some states are doing some innovative programs.
And is that for money reasons?
I think they say it's for money reasons. Actually, we would save so much more money by education and rehabilitation. So, for the example of Duktaw, just for the next 25 years, that's going to cost taxpayers over $1 million. And he didn't hurt anybody, nor did he shoot the gun. So in terms of cost, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot in society, because everybody, nearly 90% of people at some point will come back to society. Now, as a society, we have to ask ourselves the question, how do we want them to enter society? As another dependent that we have to take care of, or where their situation is such that they're going to get frustrated and be forced to commit another crime? Or do we want them to be able to have the skills to go into society and actually be productive?
Leslie, thank you.
Thank you so much, Gail, for having me.
Leslie Neal is the director of the new documentary, Juvies. For more information about the film, check out our website at here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Southern Baptists consider leaving the global fold. We'll find out why.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Iran is under increased pressure to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is investigating its nuclear program. Agency Director Mohammad El-Baradei asked Iran to clear up concerns about its uranium enrichment activities within the next few months. The U.S. has long accused Iran of trying to build nuclear weapons. Iran says its program is only for generating electricity. James Traub is a contributing writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. He wrote yesterday's article about the IAEA and Iran's nuclear program, and he joins us on the line from New York. James, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Gail.
And it's certainly a timely topic, with the UN's atomic watchdog now saying that Iran has not been cooperating with investigators, and in fact that Iran is trying to acquire thousands of magnets for uranium enrichment. I take it this comes as no surprise for you?
Well, the Iranians have been so dishonest about their program that any reasonable person would assume that they're trying to build a bomb. After all, why otherwise would they be so duplicitous and evasive and so on? This latest piece of news by itself is no more indicative they're trying to build a bomb than all the other stuff we've learned after they've tried to keep us from learning it. It just makes one awfully suspicious about what's going on underneath.
So this isn't necessarily a smoking gun.
Well, no, this is the problem. You see, that think about Iraq for a second. Iraq's behavior in the months leading up to the war was also deeply obstructive. Of course, it had been as well back in 98 when the inspectors were finally kicked out. So again, you thought, well, of course, they're hiding weapons of mass destruction. Well, it turned out they weren't. In the case of Iran, again, there's so much smoke you think there's fire. But the fact is, when you talk to Bush administration officials who are absolutely certain that these guys are building a bomb, and of course I'm talking about the Iranians, not the Iraqis now, they don't actually have any evidence.
Now, give us a little history here, because in the 1950s, atomic energy was viewed as something with positive as well as negative consequences. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
This whole regime of nuclear non-proliferation that we have originally dates in the 50s, as you say, when the thought was, look, let's get control of the bad aspect of nuclear power, i.e. the bomb, so that we can harness its glorious aspects for purposes of power, agriculture, medicine, and so forth. And so that beautiful horizon has now receded. On the other hand, the fear about loose nukes and so on, that fear, in a way, is even greater than in the depths of the Cold War when we feared this one other rival power.
Well, and in fact, it seems as if we don't have very good methods of dealing with some of those issues. I mean, you write from the beginning that the IAEA was a conflicted agency. What do you mean by that?
Well, they were created to enforce this bargain. That is to say, they had both sides, the peaceful side and the monitoring of the military side. And for the longest time, there was a confidence that if you said you were not doing anything bad, you weren't. And so the whole inspection program really was, frankly, a joke. And it remained a joke until Iraq in 1991. That is, after the war, inspectors went back in there and discovered, lo and behold, the Iraqis had been lying all the time. So from that time forward, nuclear nonproliferation changed because people realized we have to have a real nuclear police force that can penetrate the veil of lies and get to the truth.
Well, exactly. And should that have come as such a surprise, because clearly there was no intelligence gathering capability, and they also couldn't enforce when they found violations.
Right.
Not much they could do about it.
They couldn't do anything, though. To be fair to them, by the way, it wasn't like the world's intelligence agencies were all saying, of course the Iraqis have nuclear weapons. Nobody knew it. And so everybody was hamstrung by a lack of information about this stuff. But what we know now that we didn't know and indeed didn't exist before is that there was now this black market out there. And that means that there is now a supply. So folks who want to have a clandestine program can now get it outfitted with equipment, with drawing, with expertise, and so forth. So it's a much more frightening non-proliferation world than we thought we lived in before.
Well, and also the way this played out in terms of North Korea, as you explained in the article, the one time where the IAEA looked as if it was able to do its job, North Korea just walked out. So
right.
That must have been something of a cautionary lesson.
Here's the limit of what an inspection agency can do. The inspection agency, and indeed the whole UN system, can't do anything. Now it becomes a political problem that has to be solved through diplomacy and political pressure.
So what happens if diplomacy and political pressure aren't enough? Then what?
Well, the last thing you want to do is be in a situation where you've got two choices, you know, war or surrender. There are no good options in North Korea because war is unthinkable. Their capacity to inflict damage on South Korea, even absent the use of nuclear weapons, is immense. At the same time, we now suspect that the North Koreans are sending nuclear material. The idea of North Korea as a kind of entrepot for nuclear material is just unimaginable and unacceptable. And so we are going to have to use some combination of big carrots, big sticks, and last patience to try to deal with them. There's no good answer to that one.
Well, let's back up for a moment, if we can, to look at the biggest possible picture here. Is there a way to rewrite the nuclear bargain, as you put it, so that the world might be a little safer place?
Well, here's actually a relatively encouraging thing, which is there's agreement on something fundamental, which is it's not enough anymore to say you can't have a bomb. Now what you have to say is you can't have nuclear fuel. And so what people are thinking about now is how can they create some kind of universalized system where all the enriched fuel is under some kind of control, whether it's a treaty-based organization or whether it's multinational. There's a lot of different ways of doing it. And so you would have an assured supply but also a controlled supply of nuclear fuel so that no individual country had a pretext for creating its own system of enriching fuel.
Well, and isn't one of the difficulties of trying to put the nuclear genie back into the bottle the fact that it's a little disingenuous, some might say hypocritical, for countries that already have nuclear capability to say, well, it's okay for us to have it, but sorry, you can't.
Yeah, well, of course, that's what, you know, the Indians and the Pakistanis and so forth have been saying as they've developed their weapons all along. I think the fair question is, if you are not making an ongoing effort to reduce the stock of nuclear weapons, and you are, in fact, doing research, as the Bush administration is, on new tactical, for example, earth-penetrating, they're called, nuclear weapons, then, yes, you're putting yourself in a hypocritical position. I give the Bush administration, I think, a fair amount of credit on the disarmament side. I don't think that's quite fair. But once you're saying, well, yeah, actually, we think nuclear weapons are perfectly thinkable because we're going to develop some new ones, well, that hardly is going to help you in a debate whose premise is supposed to be these are the most unthinkable weapons man has ever devised.
James, thank you.
Thank you.
James Traub's article, Is Iran Going Nuclear?, appeared in yesterday's New York Times Magazine, where he is a contributing writer.
Still to come, the Stepford Wives for the 21st Century. We review the new and updated version.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Earlier today, President George Bush helped unveil the official portraits of former President Bill Clinton and former First Lady and current New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton at a White House ceremony. In praising Clinton, Bush noted his longtime optimism.
I mean, after all, you got to be optimistic to give 6 months of your life running the McGovern campaign in Texas.
In his comments, President Clinton spoke about the painter of the portraits.
Simi Knox came to us when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg recommended him to Hillary. And I looked at his work and was profoundly moved.
Simi Knox is an Alabama native, a former sharecropper, who went on to paint baseball great Hank Aaron and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. He's the first black artist to paint an official presidential portrait. We spoke with him last week and asked if he ever dreamt of such a thing.
Can you imagine an African-American born 1935 in Aliceville, Alabama? You can imagine. No, nothing like that ever entered my mind. I started working in fields when I was 5 years old.
When did you, a sharecropper, think of picking up a paintbrush?
I had no idea what those things were. I didn't know what a paintbrush was. I had no idea what art was. But I've always had the facility to draw well. In fact, I am mostly self-taught. And I just love to draw, and I draw all of the time, and so it just morphed into this.
How did you approach President Clinton's painting? What did you have to do to capture him on canvas?
It's up to you, Simi. He said, what I would like to have, though, is I'd like for my portrait to have some appearance of the Oval Office.
Well, a portrait artist has to capture the scene that a person wants to be in, but as you know, they have to capture the soul a little as well. How'd you do that, or did you think you did?
Well, I think I did. I have the ability to be with a person for a short period of time, and I can see in their face that image or that spirit that's in them that I'd like to portray. I just wanted to present him, and he agreed, as take me as I am. It's a straight on. It's not a broad smile. It's a kind of a look. He's facing the viewer. The eyes will track you in that portrait. As you move from one side of the portrait to the other, the eyes will follow you. And he's just straight on. No side glances, nothing like that, but take me as I am. And from what I understand, he and his wife, they were pleased with what I captured. And so, especially when the wife is happy, yeah. I'm happy because they know him better than anyone.
Yeah. Did you feel a connection with your subject?
I always felt connected to him for some reason, because when he came into office, I told a few friends of mine, I said, I've always wanted to paint a president. And I said, and I believe that this is the one opportunity that we'll have to paint this president. And when it happened, I was so surprised. I was just shocked.
Now, you also painted the president's wife, Hillary.
I was just so pleased when she asked me if I would paint hers, because that told me that she was pleased with what I had done with her husband.
Well, Mr. Knox, there are some people who think that you have possibly now painted
two presidents. People have said that to me a number of times, and I said, right on.
Simi Knox, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Artist Simi Knox spoke to us from Maryland.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
And this sports note, to the astonishment of many, including perhaps themselves, the Detroit Pistons lead the Los Angeles Lakers 3-1 in the final round in the battle for the NBA championship title. Everyone thought the Lakers were an unstoppable force, a sure bet to win it all, even though star player Kobe Bryant has been commuting between the courtroom and the court as he faces rape charges. But something has happened. The Pistons are looking like the superior team. The Lakers, a little like the Wizard of Oz when the curtain is pulled aside. Carl, the mailman Malone, has not been delivering because of a bum knee. The normally implacable Buddhist and Lakers coach Phil Jackson has turned into Mr. Whiner, complaining about fouls. In fact, the entire Laker team seems to need a house call from Dr. Phil. Last night, the Pistons beat the Lakers 88-80. They could wrap it all up tomorrow at home in Detroit, giving coach Larry Brown his first NBA championship, the first Pistons win in 14 years. The surprise play of the Pistons has overshadowed another sports note. Former player Larry Bird, now managing the Indiana Pacers, told an interviewer, in answer to a question, that basketball was and should be a black man's game because they're the better players. But it could use a few more white players to broaden the fan base. Well, that statement was controversial, but it could also be wrong. Last night's Piston-Lakers game had ratings 66% higher than last year. Maybe all the game needs is good basketball. And after three titles in the last 4 years under Phil Jackson, maybe fans just want to see someone other than Los Angeles win the title. Before Martha Stewart became the queen of domesticity, before TV shows like Extreme Makeover surgically crafted physical perfection, we had The Stepford Wives, the 1975 cult thriller based on Ira Levin's best-selling novel. It was a cautionary tale in a time of women's lib, starring Catherine Ross as a young wife, mother, and aspiring photographer who flees the chaos of Manhattan to settle down in the pristine bedroom community of Stepford, Connecticut. But she soon discovers that husbands there trade in their wives for compliant, big-busted, happy homemaking robots. Well, now it's Nicole Kidman's turn to do battle with the sex bots in director Frank Oz's 21st century remake of The Stepford Wives. When Kidman's character Joanna arrives in Stepford, Glenn Close, as Claire, introduces her to the rest of the Stepford Wives.
Good morning, ladies.
Good morning, Claire.
I would like you all to welcome our newest citizen to Stepford, Joanna.
Good morning, Joanna.
Are we ready to work out?
Oh, yes.
Places and poles, please.
Wait, you work out dressed like this?
Well, of course. Whatever we do, we always want to look our very best. I mean, why, imagine if our husband saw us in worn, dark, urban sweat clothes with stringy hair and almost no makeup.
Well, pastel sweaters, wonder bras, and lots of makeup abound in the new Stepford. And here now's Renee Graham is in the studio to tell us what she thought about the update. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Robin.
Well, the original film, for those who saw it, was horrifying in many ways because of what it portended, but it was embraced by feminists, right?
It was a very sort of sinister and dark film about, you know, how desperate men might become to sort of stave off the advances of feminism. It took itself very, very seriously.
So how did the filmmakers update this new film? Because the old one might seem dated.
They really just kept the sort of bare framework of the original. Whereas the original was really a horror story, this one plays it all for laughs and sort of big camp value.
Well, what'd they do? Tell us some of the changes they made.
Well, I mean, for the most part, the characters are the same. You know, in the original, Catherine Ross was essentially a quote-unquote housewife, but with aspirations to be a photographer. And in the new film, Nicole Kidman is the main character, Joanna, who's this high-powered television executive who makes really bad reality TV shows like I Can Do Better, which spouses trade up, you know, from their dowdy partners to, you know, hot young studs and babes. And she loses her job after a spurned husband tries to kill her. So you know, she and her husband, who's played by Matthew Broderick, decide they're going to move to Stepford, Connecticut, you know, sort of revitalize their lives and revitalize their marriage. And of course, you know, everyone comes to learn that Stepford is the town where, you know, men are men and women are remote-controlled robots.
And there's also, in this newer version, a gay couple.
There is a gay couple. And, you know, I think part of that's because it's written by Paul Rudnick, who also wrote the film In and Out, who is himself gay. And so you end up with having sort of a gay male Stepford wife, so to speak, whose partner wants him to be less flamboyant and wants him to be more of a boring gay Republican.
It sounds like a great cast. You've got, as you mentioned, Nicole Kidman, Matthew Broderick, Bette Midler.
Bette Midler is very, very good. She plays this author who's also at Stepford, Connecticut, is brought there by her husband, and, you know, is pretty much feeling the same way Nicole Kidman's character is feeling, like, what's wrong with these people? Why are these women all so perfect? Why are they all so blonde? And they're just trying to sort of figure out what's going on in Stepford. And at one point, they're at this dance where one of the Stepford wives goes horribly, horribly out of control. And in the clip we're about to hear, Nicole Kidman and Bette Midler and Roger Bart are trying to figure out exactly what went wrong.
Well, nobody said it was going to be easy being a homemaker and a stay-at-home mom. Toughest job in the world, right?
Well, that may be, but these Stepford women, they're a whole other dimension.
Oh, like yesterday, that poor lady, Sarah Sunderson.
Walter said she's fine.
But you said she was shooting off sparks from her ears.
Well, that's the first sign.
Of what?
Cheap jewelry.
I mean, there you have an idea. They're going for laughs. There's no feeling of, you know, oh my God, what happened to this woman? Why were sparks coming out of her ears? It's all about the easy joke.
Christopher Walken is in the film as well.
Christopher Walken is in the film. And something sort of interesting in this film is it's almost as if some of the characters in some ways are playing off their public personas. So, of course, Christopher Walken is a little bit quirky. He's married in the film to Glenn Close, who's, in a strange way, even a more frightening character than she played in Fatal Attraction.
Or, you know, Cruella DeVille.
Or Cruella DeVille. You know, she's perfect. You know, she's sort of the realtor. She gets the couples to come here, and she's just all sweetness and nice. But, of course, everyone knows it can't quite be that. And even in a way, I felt Nicole Kidman was sort of playing on her own persona. Because let's face it, when she was married to Tom Cruise, she looked like a little bit of a Stepford wife on the red carpet with him.
Is there any careful examination of any of the issues that women face, you know, having it all, trying to balance work and home, you know, keep a marriage together? Anything addressed seriously?
You know, there might have been in some of the earlier drafts of the film, but not to me. I didn't find those in the final draft. But that's okay, because the film is very funny. In the scene we're about to hear, Nicole Kidman and Bette Midler's characters go to the Stepford Wives book club, and Nicole Kidman begins to sort of talk about the book that she's interested in, and then she realizes the book that they'll be doing that month.
We are all so thrilled to be here at the Stepford Book Club, I can't tell you. Now, I have just finished the third volume of Robert Caro's Life of Lyndon Johnson, and I am dying for the next installment.
Well, that's all marvelous.
But today we're going to discuss, well, it is probably the most important book any of us will ever read.
Oh.
Yes, it's provocative, but it's also inspiring.
The Heritage Hills Special Edition Golden Deluxe Treasury of Christmas Keepsakes and Collectibles.
I mean, and of course, you know, Nicole Kidman and Bette Midler are really just looking at each other wondering, what have we gotten ourselves into at this place? What are these women all about?
Renee, it sounds like you really liked the film, but there have been all these rumors about the last-minute cuts, the addition of an epilogue. You know, there was concern that maybe it was derailing.
I definitely did like the film. I found it very funny, but it isn't hard to imagine that the filmmakers were probably wrestling with exactly what tone they wanted to take with this material. Do they make it into a thrill? Do they make it into a comedy? Is it a comedy with dramatic overtones? The ending of this film spoofs the sort of shocking ending of the original, but it's completely different. It's, you know, it's a happier, much more upbeat film than the original was.
Well, Renee, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Here now is Renee Graham, also pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe, with her review of the new Stepford Wives.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Andrea Meyer, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Cindy Howes. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our intern is Nick Weiss-Richmond.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.